Well, we finished up with the 13th chapter just transitionally. The whole chapter has to do with, in the beginning, with the relationship of Christians to government, and therefore is a practical thing. There's a lot of practical instruction in the Scripture if we would look for it, and it's necessary instruction. And I've more or less tried to direct you in the line of saying, don't spend a lot of time trying to be spiritual. Just give attention to living on the earth and let God take care of the spiritual thing, because we can't do anything about it anyway. So we've kind of gone down that road. And so people need to know how to get along in government, but also in various aspects of daily living. And toward the end of the 13th chapter, you have some instructions on loving the neighbor. And I might remind you that that is not such an unreachable task. Most people attach an extremely high value or a high interpretation of this matter of love, and then it sits there and they never reach it anyway. Some people get a little nervous about my translation of the word love, which is only caring. The agape love from the Greeks means to care, and it's a matter of the will. And people get a little incensed about that, but then they spend the rest of their life worrying about the fact they don't have any love, see? They set their sights too high. And, of course, most people say, oh, well, you can't set your sights too high. Well, if you can't, then how come you never reach it, see? No, we have to be practical. I'm not just giving you my evaluation of the word. I'm taking it out of the Greek text, agape. And it definitely is not charged with emotions. It's a word that is volitional. It's a matter of the will. It's attainable by us all. But it's only attainable if you strip it of its emotional, humanistic aspects. Because then you see you have God's love in your spirit. God's love in the spirit naturally evolves in caring. You see that? So that's the great difference, the shift that takes place from the moment you're saved, before you were saved, and I'm using the word perhaps carelessly here because I don't mean to imply that there is necessarily a precise moment when you are saved and you are not. Difficult thing to nail down. You can't say I was not saved at 12 o'clock on Saturday night and I was saved at 12:30 a.m. or something. You can't really necessarily pin it down. Some people can mark that, but for most people it's an evolving thing, and they don't really know the moment that they did finally, in their minds and in their hearts, become committed to Christ. From the moment Christ really does take up his place in our spirits, there is a new sense of caring that takes place in all of us. It's not something even that has to be forced or worked up, especially when you rid it of the emotional aspects, because what it just means is that suddenly you give attention to God when you didn't before. And now it matters to you how you behave. That's caring. It begins to matter to you about people around you that need help. That's caring. You see, all of this is caring. Now, there is a difference between the sense of caring and the practice of caring. When Christ is in our spirits, we have the sense of caring. We think about others. We think about God. The Bible is full of instructions that help us in the practice of caring, you see, to focus our mind not on self but on others and so on. That's the practice of caring. But all of us have the caring as we have the Spirit. And that's why, as we've so often pointed out in Galatians 5, the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, and so on. Why? Because when the Spirit is in us, that's what is in us. To say, well, the Spirit of God is in me, but I don't love very much or I don't do this very much, misses the whole point. Once again, people that usually talk about saying, you know, do you have the fruits of the Spirit? And quote, they often think in terms of getting a second dip, you know, because they feel they don't love enough or they don't have enough of this or that. So they're going to have another shot and get the what they call a baptism of the Spirit or the filling of the Spirit, whatever it is. Now, the problem with that whole thing is that they're relying on their own evaluation of emotions to say they don't have those things. They think just because they don't run up and throw their arms around everybody that they must not have love. And they have the naive notion that the most gracious thing to do is to balance out people's offenses by some good quality, you know. And they say, well, if you can't cover the offense by trying to find good traits in the offended, in the offender. For example, someone robs a bank. He's a thief. Now, we don't acquit him in court just because he may also love his mother, you see, because he's got some good trait. We don't list all the good traits. His attorney doesn't give him court. They list all his good traits and say we can't send it. Oh, they do sometimes. I mean, basically, the issue of the thievery is still there. And that's what he's being judged for, is thievery. I'm saying by that token that you can't say, well, this person treats me very badly, but after all, they're very philanthropic or very charitable, so I must like them. And we don't have to. I've tried to go over that with you many times, but I think a classic example of what I'm trying to say here is Jesus. Jesus had great care for the Pharisees. He prayed for them. He wept over them as he wept over Jerusalem. You that have killed the prophets, and so forth and so forth. How often I would have gathered you. And he wept over them. But he didn't like them. And he called them snakes. They were offending God's people, these Pharisees. They were ripping them off. They were extortioners, and they were phonies and all the rest. And he told them that. He didn't say, oh, well, we mustn't be critical of the Pharisees because they're very nice people. They take care of their mothers and daddies. No, he called a spade a spade. So, by the same token, if we understand this difference, then we are comfortable with the command to love your neighbor. If we don't understand what I'm saying, we are never comfortable with that command because we never think we love enough. You will never be satisfied that God has given you help in the matter of love if you don't understand this. You can set your sights way up in the stratosphere and keep climbing and climbing to get there, and you'll never get there. And I'm trying to pull our sights down. Of course, that's why a lot of people think I'm a scoundrel, then, because I'm not giving people the great noble heights, but I've been around the block a few times. And I don't find all the people with the noble ideals living up to them. So I say, let's reinterpret. Let's reevaluate. Maybe the Bible is saying something different. And it is. Because what I'm saying to you about love is absolutely in keeping with the understanding of the text, of the language of the text. But it's not the understanding of English. If you take the word English, the word love in English, you are absolutely at sea because it means nothing. And everything. It's a totally vacuous, inane, inarticulate word is love in English. So I have to interpret it for you. And so now we see the balance, as I've gone over many times, between human affection and agape, which is the love of caring, which is what God brings to our spirits. And he doesn't really... this is very wild statements. But he's not that concerned about how we apply our emotional reactions. You see, the thing, people don't understand personality and human nature and so forth. That's a problem. I spent a great many years studying it and teaching it because I felt that I needed to understand the makeup of the human person and weigh it against the discussions of the Scripture about this thing. And that's why I keep away from spiritualizings that leave us without footing up in the clouds. In this matter of human nature, human personality, there's no question but what we have different temperaments, personalities, from a genetic point of view. The genes have given us certain traits. Beyond that, the environment, the circumstances have added to these characterizations. And so we have habits that we develop, and we have attitudes we develop. So this all is what is personality. That makes up our personality. A cortex that has all kinds of nerve paths in it and all kinds of patterns and habits and so forth is stored up. And we've accumulated that. So year after year, we accumulate a set of ideas and attitudes and so forth that make up our personality, which is in a way an ever-changing thing as we live experiences out. At the same time, it has a kernel that is probably pretty study. For example, you have on the one extreme, the extrovert, the outgoing personality. On the other extreme, the introvert, the inner person. Now, throughout the lifetime, people will probably use that as, that'll be probably the kernel of their temperament, but they might vary a little bit. Some people can begin to blossom a little bit, by effort and so forth. But generally speaking, we have a pretty fixed personality. Some of these traits, personality matters, are changeable. Habits can change, attitudes can change. As we get new information, new data, new understanding, new experiences, changes do take place within the personality. But generally speaking, people have some very strong character traits that do not change. It's hypothetical whether they could change, but they don't change. So now you've got temperament coming into the picture. Now, for example, you have the excitable temperaments, a temperament that is volatile, highly emotional, and this kind of person can be way up or way down. The level of height that they reach also is, by the same token, the level of the depths that they reach, too. I mean, the very excitable type of person may also become very depressed. In a lot of circles, they call it manic depressive, but I think sometimes psychologists reach for a label and reach for a pill to meet the label, so they've done something that they can get insurance money for in the process. But I've talked to a great many people who have been labeled manic depressive, because that's the handiest one to pull out of the hat there, out of the file. And you can put that down in the insurance form, but you can't say this person has emotional disturbance. You've got to say they have something, and this is the pill for it, and the insurance people will pay for the pill. So it's a problem. But these are labels that are often unsound and very careless to put labels on people of any kind, because life is fluctuating, personality is fluctuating. On the other hand, there are people that have a rather even temperament. They never get excited much about anything. More or less, that's the pattern I'm in. I don't get too much up, too much down. I just chug along and do my job. But the point is that we don't attach spiritual value to those two temperaments. So people that look at the religious situation, you see, and they say, and as, of course, obviously, anyone from a background which has been quite expressive emotionally will probably not be too happy with my meetings. Whereas some people, highly expressive of their affections for God, let us say, they think Jesus is groovy, they think God is grand, I have all the feeling. I don't mean to be a satirical here. I may be a little cynical, but I don't mean to satirize anything. But people, they feel very good about God, and they have good affectionate feelings about it, and God doesn't mind that, I'm sure. And people who want to express themselves more openly do that. On the other hand, there has to be place for the people, for example, whose emotional makeup has been drained or crushed by sequences of tragedy or catastrophe or something. There are people, a lot of people in this world, that have, because of years and years of circumstance, they don't have very much left. They're dulled to pleasure and pain. They're dulled to it. They just chug along. Now, I say to you that becoming Christians does not suddenly make that person an ebullient, happy-go-lucky, vibrant person. And I'm just saying there has to be place for both temperaments. So some people talk about love for God, and they feel they must express that in various ways that are emotional. That's all right. See, that's all right with God. On the other hand, the people who are not so emotionally oriented are just as much in God's favor. Because it's not a matter of how spiritual you are, it's a matter of your personality and your temperament. What has happened in your life? I'm glad to have a place here, a small place. I mean by that, a small little corner. The house is lovely. There's a small little corner in the body of believers where a few souls who have been through a lot in life can come and feel at peace. I have had people come to meetings fresh out of tragedies. We had one in our meeting some years ago up here. They had just lost their baby. That morning, they were able to come to the meeting and be comforted. Young woman, some time ago, just lost a very favorite grandfather, somebody who raised her, just lost in that morning, was able to come and find comfort in the meeting. Nobody grabbed her hand and pumped it. Nobody threw their arms around her. Nobody asked her to stand up and wave her arms or anything. So what I'm really trying to say to you is we can't use emotions as a gauge of what is going on in our spirit. We don't rule out emotions as being important, as being more important to some than others, perhaps. We don't rule out affection. We don't say that the love of God is void of affection. But we say that intrinsically, the word, agape, does not require emotional involvement. And people try to put it on a logical basis. Oh, God has been so good to us, we just have to be rejoicing and so forth and so forth. But if you're working with people for whom disaster has followed and followed faster, as Poe says, we have to give place to concern, to a mood that may not be primarily able to involve the emotion. So it is really the love of God himself. See, when you take God into your spirit, you take his love into your spirit, and you take him. His love manifests itself in many ways beyond our feelings, or our capacity to feel, beyond our affections, or our capacity for affections. There are people born with temperaments that are just naturally modest in affection. I don't want to be too harsh, although I'm going to have to say I've had many counseling situations wherein I have felt from a lot of discussion that the person had a streak in them that was unusually void of affection as such, of emotion. It often is in the form of we call it a trauma on the psyche. A trauma, of course, in medically is an open wound of some kind. If you cut yourself with a knife, that's a trauma. If it's not cut, if the skin isn't broken, it's not a trauma. See, okay. Now, there are scars in the psyche. If you were to kind of look at the brain on a graph paper, and you were to take a pencil or a pen and make a jagged line across that graph. All right. Now, there is the pattern of the cortex of the brain, it's not that neat, but there is a pattern on the cortex as a pattern of thinking. And then you take this jagged line across it, which represents some kind of traumatic experience on the part of the individual, or some kind of a genetic trait that is screwy. Just think in terms of the fact that you can follow very neatly those little squares, and then as long as you stay away from the jagged line, everything is neat. But the moment you hit that jagged line, everything falls apart. Now, you know people like that, perhaps. That everything is fine to a point, and some kind of thing always tends to trigger them off like that. And they become not themselves, even. They just become very... They'll lash out at people in such anger. They're almost beside themselves in the next... minute almost, or the next hour, they've suddenly calmed down, and they're just different people. Sometimes we look at that in terms of hyperglycemia, for example, people whose blood sugar drops to a certain level, and they haven't gotten proper food or something like that, and their blood sugar drops too low. That person can suddenly become quite excitable and different in their temperament, and maybe very hurtful and very hard to deal with. You see, I'm being realistic, dear friends, beloved friends. I'm being realistic about temperament versus spirituality. And I'm seeing a lot of times where the church just wants to put a label on it, spiritual or not spiritual. It's far more complicated than that. You can't just say everybody that comes to Christ is going to suddenly be cheerful and highly emotional and so forth about it, any more than you can say everyone that becomes a Christian suddenly becomes very voluble, very vocal, goes out and talks a lot about things. If this were really a spiritual measure, then the people that were born with the temperaments to go with that would have an edge on the rest of us. It isn't quite that simple. So I want us to, when it says love your neighbor, it doesn't mean that you have to A, go out and throw your arms around a neighbor, or B, that you have to always be doing nice things for the neighbor, or C, that you have to cover their offenses by searching for traits that are good, or D, that you have to like it even if they run over your flower bed or their child throws a rock through your window. I want you to be able to meet this phrase, love your neighbor, without always going under the guilt trip. And I think there are people who for 20 or 30 years have read that phrase and always felt guilty. And I will predict for you, if you saw it in a different light, in the other light of the emotional thing or the other kinds of things, if you saw it in that light, I guarantee you that from this day forth, you would never be able to read the phrase without some guilt. But that is not a good thing. To live under the onus of guilt all our lives is totally contrary to the spirit of the grace of God and creates very difficult problems for us when we begin to ask, why did God put it all together if he's going to be so terribly unhappy with all of us all the time? Then we can't be happy that he made the place. Some are not altogether happy at it even now. But to live under bondage is contrary to Jesus' teaching. Jesus said, if the Son therefore shall make you free, you shall be free indeed. Well, of course, you either have to say God's standards are too high, or that Jesus has not really made us free and therefore we're not saved. And I submit to you that 99% of Christendom would have to identify themselves as not saved if they were to take seriously some of the high goals that are being set. Now, when Jesus comes, he makes us free. It would be no deal for us if he just put us under deeper bondage. If becoming a Christian merely meant you had a tougher set of rules to live by and a harder life, where is the advantage at all? What does Christ really do for him? How can he even talk about freedom? Yet Paul and Christ, Jesus both talk about freedom continuously. You're called unto liberty, he says. Jesus says, the Son shall make you free, you shall be free indeed. Paul said, having begun in the Spirit, I am now made perfect in the flesh. And he says, O foolish Galatians, who hath bewitched you? And he said, you have been under freedom and liberty, and now all of a sudden somebody's put you under bondage. And he says, who has done this? You did run well. Who did hinder you? Jesus came to set us free. Now, you see, the Spirit is perfect in love. But the natural man, the mind, does not always express that love adequately. And that's something that we have to live with, and we wrestle with that, in terms of saying that we ought to continually be sensitive to the fact that God wants us to be kind to people, and he wants us to forgive, and he wants to do all these things. Now, we get help from God in these things. We get his help in terms of love and our control of the self by, one, the motivation of the Spirit. See, that having the caring of God in our spirit, we are motivated to control these things or to live well. Secondly, we get this through instruction. We learn as we read the Word that God is pleased to have us kind to one another and to be forgiving and so forth. Third, we learn control by experiences that we have. We learn the cost of carelessness, the cost of lack of control. I've said that before. You lose a job because you lose your temper. It may have been understandable that you would lose the temper, and we may pat you on the head and say, I sympathize with you, brother or sister, but that doesn't get the job back. And the same with marriages. You see, you say, well, I just can't control my temper. And I just have to say to somebody, well, you may have to lose your marriage then. Or at least the affection of the other person. I've had people say to me, about the children, I said, but well, I just can't help but blow up. I just lose my temper all the time. And I said, I'm with you. I sympathize. We're all wretches on the earth, and I understand that. And I don't condemn you for it. But if your children walk out, don't blame them. You know, in this matter of our feelings toward others, we hope people will be long-suffering and patient. But don't bank on it. You understand that? You say, well, people ought to be long-suffering. They ought to put up with me. Well, maybe they should, but they don't. And every time you blast somebody, you may think you have every good reason to do it, but you're going to take a chunk out of the affection. Now, that's not going to send you to hell, but it may cause you problems in your marriage. And I can't say it won't. I can't say to you, and the person may say, well, I didn't think we have to control ourselves that much. Well, you don't if you don't mind losing your marriage. If you want to be alone, you can do anything you want. Go out and scream in the wilderness. If you want people to like you, you have to be likable. You can only bank so long on their long-suffering and patience, good Christians though they be. Those are admirable virtues, but not always dependable. It's not an easy thing to get hold of. Also, I want to say to you that that is not the criterion for being a Christian. You can be in God's family and still have trouble controlling your temper, for example. This is a natural temperament. Some people have an easier time than others. The thing is, we have to cut this away from the essential concept of love, which is caring, and which is not dependent upon human emotions or affections. So people can really love God very deeply, in the caring very deeply, and yet be very unemotional in their expression of it. And they can care about others all around them and help others and yet have difficulty relating to people. Human relationships are always difficult. There's no easy road to human relationships. And we win some and lose some. So that's just a human thing. I'll take every Christian on earth and say to you that sometimes they do well and sometimes they do not do well. And just about the time you think you've got this relationship under control, something else pops up and falls apart. The love of God within us is steady as a rock and stable, and it is there, and it is what keeps us tied to God. It does reach out beyond us to others around us, so that you may find yourself quite surprisingly caring about somebody you haven't liked very well, but you care and you hear that they've had a certain tragedy in their lives. Immediately you pray for them. Immediately you care. So all the disruptions of the human relationship does not cause the caring to cease or the praying to cease. And that is the evidence that God's love is in us. See, if it is otherwise than what we're saying to you here tonight, 99% of Christendom is in trouble. There may be 1% angelic that do not have these kinds of problems. I'd say that most Christians are constantly struggling with them, but by misclassifying them, misfiling them, a lot of these spiritual qualities that we're taught people talk about are misfiled under spiritual when they should be personality or natural problems. By misfiling them, we misapply them. We do change. In the flesh, as far as our human self is concerned, it isn't the self that changes so much as it is the practices that change, the behavior changes. To keep touch with the Scripture, Jesus and Paul both together, and the others as well, but they were sort of the mainstay of the theological position, Jesus and Paul together both made a specific point of the fact that there is no good thing in the flesh. And not just in the one passage in Romans, but on in Philippians, Paul said, I have no confidence in my flesh. What changes is the spirit. And what also changes would be the behavior patterns as we grow and we grow up. We change, but that is a change of behavior pattern and not a change of nature. The spirit changes in nature because the spirit suddenly becomes a God spirit again. The flesh changes only in behavior as we grow and grow up, as we learn and experience. Now, how God goes about helping us to deal with ourselves in this life is through the threefold way of ministering through His Spirit in teaching us things, and through experiences in life that make changes. You don't even have to try. Sometimes you get hit so hard with something that you're just a different person. That's right. That's a good thing. And those things happen to all of us. And then by motivation, God in the Spirit gives us the motive for change because we care. We try to control ourselves not because it makes us more spiritual, but because wanting to please Christ, we try to change. It doesn't make you more spiritual, but being spiritual or having the Spirit of Christ, we want to change. There's no other basic motive. Even consequences don't give us enough motive. Because, you know, witness all the cigarette ads and so forth that show the dire consequences of smoking, but nobody pays attention to them. There are lots of things where consequences aren't enough. So what then? Well, the motive is that we want to please Christ. That's what we're trying to get across to you. I want you to be at peace about yourselves. I want you to be able to face this verse, love your neighbor as yourself, without a perennial, relentless guilt trip. Because then we would have to say, if I had to go that route, I'd say, to heck with the whole thing. It may be lovely, but I'll never make it. But I'm no different than you are. And everywhere, I suppose, in the ministry is, I try to provide a refuge for the losers like myself. I mean, the people. Yeah, I mean, for people who have tried to be honest about their lives and have not bought some unattainable factor. I've been through all of it. Every kind of conceivable religious experience that you can name, and gone to the top in all of them and found the emptiness of all of them. I've found the emptiness in religious propositions, as many people have found the emptiness in the world. Found some emptiness there too. But I mean, I've found the emptiness of all these empty promises that you can be this and this and this and all be so spiritual. And it lasts a week and it's back down again, going after another shot. And every time they make a mistake, they're back down in the trough again, and they got to find a way out. And I'm just trying to put you on stable ground to say, in our spirits there exists the love of Christ and the peace of Christ and the grace of Christ and the faith of Christ, and it is stable and steady, and it'll hold you steady all the years of your life. And you don't need to get yourselves all fouled up by going after these highfalutin spiritual experiences. Now, this has served me nicely for 40 years. I'm still at it. More committed than ever to Christ. More deeply concerned than ever. And yet, practicing the very things I'm talking to you about here. An important thing to consider is that for a Christian, Satan still hasn't won. Even if a person commits suicide, it doesn't mean their spirit is lost. There's nothing in the Scripture that says a suicide is lost. It's a pretty big gap if you have to say that suicide is murder and murderers. I wouldn't even pay attention. I've known some pretty fine Christian leaders who committed suicide. Missionaries. I know a missionary committed suicide, a young fellow. I know the president of a very, very prominent, but I won't name it, very, very prominent Bible school that committed suicide. It would be tragic for me to condemn those persons and say, well, they couldn't have been saved. That would just be stupid. Just stupid. And in one case, just recently that happened, a young woman I was working with who then got into a charismatic group. And, you know, they were gathering around and praying out demons and all this kind of stuff. And I'm confident their approach to things finally drove her to suicide. Two people in the same group committed suicide. A charismatic group. Well, I'll tell you, it's a dangerous thing to get people on guilt trips and get them into the spiritualizations. I've seen too much. And I'd rather speak to a dozen of you people that are willing to listen to this than to speak to thousands who want some of this high spiritualization stuff. I'll take my chances on this side more than I will on the other. But people can't always stand these things, you know. We don't know who we've got out there in the congregation. And I just helped one young woman that was trying to commit suicide two or three times a week, and she was going to a charismatic group. Finally got her away from that and got
Yeah,
you know, every time a sermon would be preached, like, for example, Revelation chapter 3 is a favorite text, you know, about lukewarm people that God is going to spew out of their mouth. And right away, you know, zero, an arrow goes through the girl's heart. They're telling her she's got demons and all that kind of stuff. She finally got away. After 5 or more years, she hadn't tried it since. She's going along, she writes beautiful letters. Now, I have a notebook full of stuff from her that was negative, black, death wish stuff. And all of a sudden, she spun around. She's writing some material that I'm, in fact, going to put in a messenger, and I mean a poem and testimony from her. So these are dangerous things. No, it is not true that only sinners commit suicide.
David, I'm not sure I understand. In other words, if a person is a Christian and commits suicide, that does mean that they are rejected.
No, not at all. Oh, no. They just have come under pressures, and things have just gotten tough for them, and they've decided to take their lives. If you've ever had to give a funeral service for a suicide, that brings you to reality very fast. For example, maybe I've mentioned this, a police officer went berserk. He robbed a bar, and then he went out, and as his fellow officers were chasing him, he took his revolver out and shot himself. Left a bride of 1 year and a 5-day-old baby. And, you know, that's a tough kind of funeral to give. But you've got to give people hope, and you have no reason not to give them hope. Things just get too much for people. And God's gracious. We've got to put our weight on the side of God's grace. I know it's a lot like the leverage of being able to scare people into the... I scare the hell out of them, as they say. They like to scare people to death so they'll become Christians and so forth. It really paints such a bleak picture of God that we go like Brian Thanatopsis. Brian's poem, Thanatopsis on Death, he said, go not like the quarry slave. And I think a picture of God is presented in such a way that people that do come to him have to come like quarry slaves. You know? He says in Psalm 103, like as a father pitieth his children, so the Lord pitieth them that fear him. For he knoweth our frame, he remembereth that we are dust. He remembers that we are dust.